You're lying next to the person who's supposed to understand you better than anyone, and yet you've never felt more alone. You're both grieving the same person, the same loss, the same gaping hole in your lives, but it's like you're speaking completely different languages, and neither of you has a translation guide. If you're experiencing this unbearable tension, where your partner seems to be moving on too quickly while you're still drowning, if you find yourself furious at how they're expressing their grief or not expressing it at all, if you're tiptoeing around each other, afraid that mentioning the loss will shatter whatever fragile peace you've managed to build, if you feel guilty for grieving differently or resentful that they're not grieving the right way, if the silence between you has grown so thick you could cut it with a knife, if you're wondering how the same loss that should have brought you closer has instead built a wall between you, if you're lying awake at night feeling like you've lost not just the person who died, but your partner too, if every conversation about the loss turns into a fight or ends in someone walking away, if you're exhausted from trying to grieve in a way that makes sense to your partner instead of what your body actually needs, if you've started to wonder whether your relationship can even survive this, then you need to hear what I'm about to share with you. You've probably tried forcing yourself to grieve at the same pace, sitting down for those awkward, we need to talk about our feelings conversations that somehow make everything worse. You've likely attempted to hide your grief to protect your partner, or maybe you've done the opposite, demanded they show more emotion, cry more, talk more, be more like you. You've probably read articles about the stages of grief, thinking if you could just identify which stage each of you is in, everything would click into place. You might have tried grief counseling, where you sat on opposite ends of a couch, each feeling misunderstood and defensive. You've possibly thrown yourself into keeping busy, or the opposite. You've tried to force yourselves to sit with the pain together, only to discover that sitting together while feeling completely disconnected is even worse than being in separate rooms. Maybe you've bitten your tongue 100 times when your partner laughed at something, wondering how they could possibly find anything funny right now. Or perhaps you've tried to schedule grief, setting aside specific times to remember and mourn, as if sorrow follows a calendar. You might have even caught yourself keeping score, mentally tallying who's cried more, who mentions the loss more often, who's really grieving, and who's just pretending everything is fine. Here's what I want you to understand. None of this has worked because you've been operating under a fundamental misunderstanding about what grief is and how it moves through different people. In the next hour, I'm going to introduce you to something I call the Grief Translation Bridge, a framework that will help you understand why your partner's grief looks so different from yours, without that difference being a threat or a judgment. You're going to learn the 5 grief languages that people speak, and more importantly, how to recognize which language your partner is using so you can finally stop misinterpreting their healing as callousness or their pain as weakness. You'll discover why trying to grieve in sync actually prevents healing, and what to do instead that allows you both to process this loss authentically while staying connected. I'll show you the exact phrases that build bridges instead of walls, and the specific rituals that honor both grief styles without requiring either of you to change who you are. By the end of this audio, you'll have a clear roadmap for supporting each other without abandoning yourself, and you'll understand how 2 completely different grief journeys can coexist in the same relationship, not just without destroying it, but actually deepening your connection in ways you never imagined possible. But I need something from you first. This isn't going to work if you listen to this while doing dishes or driving or half paying attention. What I'm about to share with you requires your full presence, because some of it is going to challenge beliefs about grief you've held your entire life. Some of it might even make you uncomfortable at first, because it will ask you to let go of the idea that there's a right way to mourn. So here's what I need. Find a quiet space where you won't be interrupted for the next hour. If you're listening with your partner, that's beautiful, but you each need to commit to hearing this with an open heart, not preparing your defense or your rebuttal. If you're listening alone, commit to staying through the difficult parts, especially the moments when you hear something that makes you think, but my partner needs to hear this, not me. Trust me, you both need to hear all of it. Can you make that commitment right now? Because your relationship is worth this hour. The person you lost deserves for their death not to destroy the living, and you deserve to grieve authentically without losing the person lying next to you. Let's begin. So, why does this keep happening? Why do couples who love each other desperately find themselves becoming strangers in the very moment they need each other most? You're not failing at grief. The problem runs much deeper than that. Let's start with what you've probably already tried. Most grief counseling and advice will tell you to communicate more, to share your feelings openly, to create rituals together. And look, that's not bad advice. It's just incomplete. Because here's what nobody tells you. Talking about your grief doesn't help if you're speaking fundamentally different languages. You can communicate constantly and still feel utterly alone if neither person understands what the other is actually saying. Think about it. One person says, "I need to talk about them constantly," and the other hears, "You're not grieving hard enough if you can move on to other topics." The other person says, "I need quiet and space," and their partner hears, "You're shutting me out because I'm grieving wrong." You're both broadcasting on different frequencies, wondering why the other person isn't receiving your signal. So you talk more, share more, try harder, and somehow end up feeling even more isolated. The communication itself becomes another place where you're failing each other, another wedge driven between you. The surface-level advice assumes that if you just express yourselves clearly enough, understanding will follow, but it won't, because the real problem isn't communication, it's interpretation. It's the meaning you assign to different grief expressions, and until you address that fundamental translation issue, no amount of sharing feelings will bridge the gap. Now let's look at something even bigger working against you. We live in a culture that has absolutely no functional framework for couples' grief. Think about it. When someone dies, we have maybe a week of acknowledged mourning, a few days off work if you're lucky. Casseroles appear, people check in, and then silence. After 2 weeks, you're expected to be doing better. After a month, people stop asking. After 3 months, mentioning your grief makes others uncomfortable. But here's the twisted part. While the world is telling you both to move on, it's also feeding you a completely contradictory message through media and culture. Every romance movie tells you that true love means instinctively knowing what your partner needs. Every relationship article promises that soulmates are naturally in sync. So you're getting pummeled with two opposing forces. The outside world is saying, "Get over it already," while relationship mythology is saying, "If you really loved each other, you'd be grieving in perfect harmony." You're set up to fail from every angle. There's no template for one person needs to cry every day and the other hasn't cried in months and both are completely normal. There's no cultural script for we loved the same person but our grief looks so different that we're fighting instead of supporting each other. The systems around you, from workplace bereavement policies to social expectations to relationship ideals, are all designed as if grief is a solo journey with a predictable timeline, not a couple's journey through completely different terrain. So you end up improvising in a vacuum with no map and no validation that what you're experiencing is even possible. And when improvisation fails, you blame yourselves instead of recognizing that you were never given the tools for this in the first place. Now, here's where it gets really insidious. When this disconnect starts hurting, when you're feeling alone despite being together, the natural instinct is to try to fix it by forcing alignment. One person thinks, if I just grieve more quietly, we'll stop fighting. The other thinks, if I can just get them to open up like I do, we'll reconnect. So you start suppressing or performing your grief, trying to shape it into something your partner can recognize and validate. And this is catastrophic, because grief that gets pushed down doesn't disappear. It metastasizes. It turns into resentment, physical illness, emotional numbness, explosive anger at random triggers. When you try to grieve the way you think you should, instead of the way you actually need to, you're damming up that river we talked about earlier. The water doesn't stop flowing. It just floods everything around it, eroding the banks, creating destruction in places that should have been safe.
I've seen this play out in devastating ways. The person who naturally grieves through staying busy and moving forward starts feeling guilty, like their efficiency somehow dishonors the dead. So they force themselves to sit in sadness they're not ready for, and it comes out as irritation and withdrawal. Meanwhile, their partner, who needs to process through tears and talking, starts feeling like they're too much, too emotional, too stuck. So they stuff it down, smile when they want to scream, and that suppressed grief leaks out as passive aggression or chronic anxiety. You both end up performing grief theater for each other, neither actually healing, both feeling fake, and the distance between you grows even wider. The very attempt to close the gap makes it worse. You're not just grieving your loss anymore. You're grieving the relationship you used to have, the person your partner used to be, the team you thought you were. But underneath all of this, hidden beneath the communication problems and cultural failures and suppression patterns, there's something even more fundamental at work, something I call the grief isolation protocol. And this is the invisible enemy that's really destroying couples. Here's what it is. Deep in your unconscious mind, you carry a belief that you absorbed from every movie, every story, every observation of grief you've ever witnessed. The belief says that identical grief expressions equal identical love, that if two people really loved someone the same amount, their grief would look the same, sound the same, move at the same pace. It's the idea that there's a correct way to grieve, and deviations from that correct way reveal something about the depth or authenticity of your love. So when your partner grieves differently than you do, your brain doesn't interpret it as they're traveling a different path through the same pain. Your brain interprets it as evidence that maybe they didn't love as deeply, or evidence that you're grieving wrong, or evidence that you're fundamentally incompatible, or evidence that they don't understand what you've lost, which means they don't understand you. And once that interpretation takes hold, the grief isolation protocol activates. You retreat. You start grieving alone, in private, where you won't be judged or misunderstood. You build walls around your pain, because sharing it hasn't brought you closer, it's only highlighted how differently you're experiencing this. Your partner does the same thing, for the same reasons, and suddenly you're both in solitary mourning, each convinced the other has fundamentally failed to show up, neither realizing you've both disappeared into separate grief bunkers. The cruel irony is that this protocol evolved to protect you. Your brain thinks it's keeping you safe from judgment and disconnection, but it's actually creating the very isolation it fears. You're not apart because you grieve differently. You're apart because you've both unconsciously decided that different grief means disconnected hearts, and that belief has made you retreat from the one person who actually shares your loss. And until you identify and dismantle this grief isolation protocol, until you recognize that different rivers can carry the same sacred water, nothing else will work. Not more communication, not more time, not more trying. Because the problem isn't what you're doing, it's what you believe about what your partner's grief means about your relationship. Now, let me introduce you to the Grief Translation Bridge, a framework that will fundamentally change how you navigate loss together. Here's the insight that changes everything. Different grief styles aren't evidence of different love levels. They're proof that the same loss ripples differently through different souls, and translating between your grief languages creates more intimacy than forcing identical expressions ever could. This approach is radically different from what most couples try. You're not attempting to grieve the same way. You're not waiting for your partner to catch up or slow down. You're not pretending to feel what you don't feel or suppressing what you do feel. Instead, you're becoming fluent in each other's grief language while honoring your own. You're building a bridge between your experiences rather than insisting you both stand on the same side. Think about the visual metaphor that captures this truth, the parallel rivers. Imagine two rivers flowing from the same mountain, your shared loss. One river crashes through rocky rapids, churning and visible and loud. The other winds slowly through meadows, deep and quiet and steady. They look nothing alike. They sound completely different. They move at different speeds through entirely different terrain, yet both are carrying the same sacred water to the ocean. Your grief doesn't need to look identical, to be equally deep, or to eventually reunite you. This is what most couples miss. You think the difference in your rivers means something is wrong, that one of you isn't grieving properly or doesn't care as much. But the terrain of your internal worlds is simply different. Your grief is taking the path your particular landscape requires, and that's not just okay, it's exactly as it should be. The Grief Translation Bridge gives you a practical system for honoring both rivers while staying connected across the distance between them. The framework follows four essential steps that spell out MAPS, because when you're in the disorienting wilderness of grief, you desperately need a map. Map your landscape. Announce your weather. Protect each other's style. Synchronize through ritual. These four steps create the structure that allows you to grieve differently while staying together. Let's walk through each step so you know exactly how to implement this in your relationship, starting today. The first step is map. You need to map your individual grief landscape by identifying your specific grief style without judgment and naming what you each need when grieving. This is the foundational step, because you cannot translate between languages you haven't identified. Most couples skip this entirely and just react to each other's grief without understanding the pattern beneath it. Grief styles generally fall along three primary spectrums. First, there's internal versus external. Internal grievers process primarily in their heads and hearts before any outward expression. They need solitude, time to think, space to feel things privately before they can articulate anything. External grievers process through expression. They need to talk, to cry visibly, to engage with others, to feel their feelings out loud. Neither is better. They're just different processing systems. Second, there's wave versus steady. Wave grievers experience grief in intense surges. They might seem fine for days, then get hit by a tidal wave of emotion that levels them. Their grief is unpredictable, cyclical, intense when it comes. Steady grievers carry a consistent low-level ache. It doesn't spike dramatically, but it never fully goes away either. It's a constant background hum of sadness that colors everything without necessarily overwhelming them at specific moments. Third, there's verbal versus physical. Verbal grievers need to talk about the loss, tell stories, speak the person's name, articulate feelings. Silence feels suffocating. Physical grievers need to move through it, to channel grief into their bodies through exercise, work, touch, or stillness. Too much talking actually makes it worse for them. Here's how you map your landscape. Sit down separately first, then together. Ask yourself, when I'm grieving, do I naturally turn inward or outward? Do I need to be alone or with people? Does my grief come in waves or is it more constant? Do I need to talk or do I need to move, to be held, to work with my hands? Write down what you discover without editing it to sound more like what you think you should feel. Then share your maps with each other, not as criticism of how you're different, but as information. I'm discovering I'm an internal processor. When something hits me, my instinct is to go quiet and withdraw, not because I don't want you, but because I need to understand what I'm feeling before I can share it. Or, I think I'm a wave griever. I'll seem okay, then suddenly I'm completely underwater, and I know that's confusing for you, but it's how my system works. This mapping session gives you the vocabulary for everything that follows. You're naming the terrain so you can stop being surprised by it. When your partner goes quiet, you won't automatically interpret it as rejection if you know they're an internal processor. When your partner suddenly breaks down after seeming fine, you won't panic or think they're getting worse if you know they're a wave griever. The second step is announce. You need to announce your grief weather report to each other daily, using simple phrases so differences become information rather than rejection. This is where the map becomes useful in real time. You've identified your patterns. Now you communicate where you are on your map, right now, today, this moment. Create simple language that gives your partner a snapshot of your current grief state without requiring a lengthy explanation. Think of it like a weather report. You don't need to explain why it's raining, you just need to know to bring an umbrella. Phrases like, "I'm in a grief storm today," or "I'm in calm waters," or "I'm in the heavy fog," give immediate context. You might develop your own shorthand. One couple I worked with used colors. "I'm in the black today" meant deep, heavy grief. "I'm in the gray" meant the constant ache without acute pain. "I'm in the blue" meant a lighter day with moments of peace. Another couple used numbers, 1 through 10, where 1 meant barely functioning and 10 meant experiencing joy without guilt. The specific language matters less than having language at all. The announcement should happen proactively, not in reaction to conflict. Ideally, first thing in the morning or when you first connect for the day. "Hey, I want you to know I'm in a grief storm today. I might be quiet or weepy, and it's not about you." This one sentence prevents hours of misinterpretation. Your partner doesn't have to guess or take your mood personally. You've given them the context they need. This works because it transforms differences from mysterious threats into manageable information. When your partner says, "I'm in calm waters today," and you're in a storm, you're not doing anything wrong by being different. You're just in different weather patterns. You can acknowledge, "Okay, I'm glad you're having a lighter day. I'm still pretty deep in it, so I might need some space this evening." Now you're coordinating rather than colliding. The announcement also gives permission. When you say, "I'm in the heavy fog," you're giving yourself permission to function at the level that fog allows. You're not going to be brilliant or efficient or emotionally available today, and that's acceptable because you've named where you are. You're also giving your partner permission to be wherever they are without needing to match you. Some couples resist this step because it feels too structured or mechanical when emotions are so raw. But structure is precisely what you need when everything else feels chaotic. The announcement provides a tiny island of predictability in the ocean of grief's unpredictability. It takes 30 seconds and prevents 30 arguments. The third step is protect. You need to protect each other's grief style by creating space for different expressions, scheduling separate grief time and together time, honoring that you can miss the same person in completely different ways. This is where you actively build the infrastructure that allows both rivers to flow without damming either one. Protection means you stop trying to make your partner grieve like you. If you're an external processor who needs to talk, and your partner is an internal processor who needs silence, protection means you find other people to talk to when your partner can't be that person. You call a friend, you see a therapist, you journal, you join a grief group. You get your legitimate need met without demanding your partner violate their own grief style to meet it. Protection also means defending your partner's grief style from external judgment, including your own. When your mom says, "Is he really okay? He hasn't cried at all," you say, "He's grieving in his own way, and I trust his process." When you catch yourself thinking, "She should be better by now," you interrupt that thought with, "Her timeline isn't my timeline, and that's okay." You become the guardian of your partner's right to grieve differently. Practically, this means scheduling separate grief time. If you need to visit the grave every week and your partner finds that painful rather than comforting, you go alone or with someone else. If you need to sort through belongings and your partner isn't ready, you do it without them or you wait. If you need to talk about memories constantly and your partner needs to not talk about it for a while, you honor both needs by creating separate spaces for each expression. One couple established separate grief Saturdays where each person could spend the afternoon grieving in whatever way they needed without coordinating. One went to the cemetery, the other went hiking. Both were honoring the same loss in completely different ways, and by not forcing togetherness during the grief, they actually had more connection when they reunited for dinner. But protection isn't just about separateness. It's equally about protecting together time from the pressure to grieve identically. When you're together, you protect the space from expectations. You might sit on the couch with your partner while they cry, without needing to cry yourself. You might hold them while they're silent, without needing them to talk. You're present to their grief, without merging with it, or fixing it, or matching it. This is incredibly hard because we're wired to want synchronization with our partners. When they're sad, we think we should be sad too, in the same way, at the same intensity. But that's not how grief works with complex individuals. Protecting each other means releasing the fantasy of identical grief and embracing the reality of parallel grief that honors the same loss through different expressions. The fourth step is synchronize. You need to synchronize through grief translation rituals by finding the third thing you both can do together that honors the loss without requiring identical emotional expression. This is the step that brings you back together after mapping, announcing, and protecting have given you space to be different. Synchronization doesn't mean feeling the same thing at the same time. It means finding shared actions that can hold both of your grief styles simultaneously. You're looking for what I call the third thing, an activity or ritual that isn't about either person's preferred grief style, but creates a container both can inhabit. For many couples, this is lighting a candle together. One might sob while doing it, the other might be completely quiet. The ritual itself doesn't require emotional synchronization, but you're both present, both honoring the loss, both together. Other third things include taking a walk together without the pressure to talk, looking at photos side by side without commentary, cooking the person's favorite meal, listening to music they loved, working together on a memorial project. The key is that the third thing must be genuinely acceptable to both people, not a compromise where one person is just tolerating it to please the other. If one person finds cemeteries deeply comforting and the other finds them traumatizing, the cemetery isn't a viable third thing, but maybe planting a tree together is, maybe creating a photo album, maybe donating to a cause in the person's name. One couple I worked with found their third thing in a completely unexpected place, doing dishes together. It sounds mundane, but after dinner, they would stand at the sink together, one washing, one drying, in quiet companionship. No pressure to talk about feelings, no expectation of crying or not crying, just the rhythm of a shared task that allowed them to be together in their separate grief without the anxiety of performing grief for each other. Another couple established a weekly remembering hour where they would each share one memory from the week, something that reminded them of the person they lost. The talker got to talk, the quiet one only had to share one thing. It created a predictable time for connection around the loss without requiring constant grief expression the rest of the week. The synchronization rituals need to be consistent, but not rigid. Maybe you light a candle together every Sunday evening. Maybe you visit the place you scattered ashes every few months. Maybe you watch a slideshow on the person's birthday. The regularity creates a shared rhythm, even when your daily grief experiences are completely different. You know that even though you're processing separately most of the time, you have these touch points where your rivers converge briefly before continuing on their separate paths. These rituals also give you something to look forward to in a landscape that often feels devoid of anything positive. You're not looking forward to grief, but you're looking forward to being together in a way that honors your loss without the pressure and conflict that unstructured grief time can create. Now, let's address the obstacles that will come up as you implement this framework, because they will come up, and you need to be ready for them. The first major obstacle is guilt. You'll feel guilty for needing space when your partner needs togetherness, or vice versa. You'll feel guilty for having a lighter day when your partner is drowning. You'll feel guilty for not crying when they're crying, or for crying when they're not. This guilt can sabotage the entire framework because it pulls you back toward forcing synchronization instead of translating between differences. When guilt shows up, remind yourself of the core insight. Different grief styles aren't evidence of different love levels. Your partner needing something different than you doesn't mean either of you loved less. You having a different reaction doesn't mean you're betraying the person you lost or your partner. The guilt is a symptom of the old belief system that says identical grief equals identical love. That belief is false. Release it as many times as you need to. The second obstacle is timing. One of you might be ready to implement this framework, while the other is too raw to think systematically about anything. If you are the one who's ready, you can start doing your part unilaterally. You can map your own landscape and announce your weather, even if your partner isn't doing the same yet. You can protect their grief style if they're not yet protecting yours. Your modeling might eventually invite them to participate, or it might just reduce the conflict enough to get through this season. Either way, you're not helpless just because your partner isn't ready to engage with the framework simultaneously. The third obstacle are other people. Your families, your friends, even your therapists might have strong opinions about how you should be grieving and whether your differences are problematic.
They might pressure you to grieve more visibly or less emotionally, or to be strong for each other in ways that violate your authentic grief styles. You'll need to protect your framework from external interference. This might mean limiting what you share with certain people or explicitly telling your support system, "We're grieving differently and that's okay. Please don't try to fix it." The fourth obstacle is your own changing landscape. Your grief style isn't necessarily static. You might start as an external processor and shift to more internal processing as time goes on. Your waves might become more steady or vice versa. This means you'll need to remap periodically, updating each other on how your grief is evolving. What you needed in month one might be completely different from what you need in month six. The framework isn't a one-time setup. It's an ongoing practice of translation as the language itself shifts. So why does this work when forcing identical grief fails? Why does translation create more intimacy than synchronization? Because translation requires you to truly see your partner as separate from you, with their own internal world that's valid, even when it's different from yours. This is the foundation of mature love, not just in grief, but in everything. When you translate instead of trying to merge, you're saying, "I see that your experience is different from mine, and I'm curious about your experience, and I value your experience enough to learn its language." That is profoundly connecting. It creates intimacy at a deeper level than simply feeling the same things at the same time, which is actually a more superficial form of connection. The framework works because it removes the constant judgment that kills connection during grief. Without these tools, every difference becomes a potential threat. Is he okay? Does she care? Are we falling apart? With the framework, differences are expected and named and accommodated. You're not constantly interpreting each other's grief as commentary on the relationship. You're trusting that both rivers are carrying the same sacred water, even when they look nothing alike. This approach also works because it's sustainable. You cannot maintain forced synchronization for the months and years that grief actually lasts. You'll exhaust yourselves and resent each other, but you can maintain translation. You can keep checking in, announcing your weather, protecting each other's space, and synchronizing through small rituals. These practices don't require emotional energy you don't have. They provide structure when everything else is formless. So now you know how to build that grief translation bridge between your mourning styles. You understand that your different ways of grieving don't have to pull you apart. Now let's talk about exactly how you're going to put this into practice, starting right now while you're still listening to this. Here's what I want you to do before you even finish this episode. Identify one person in your life who's grieving the same loss, but doing it completely differently. Maybe it's your partner who's quiet when you need to talk. Maybe it's your sister who's organizing closets while you can barely get out of bed. Maybe it's your parent who seems to have moved on when you're still in pieces. Just one person. Hold them in your mind right now, because by the end of today, you're going to offer them something that might change everything between you. Today, in the next few hours, you're going to have what I call a translation conversation. You're going to reach out to that person, and you're going to say something like this: "I've been thinking about how differently we're handling this loss. I want you to know that I see you're grieving in your own way, and I want to understand it better. Can you help me understand what you need right now?" That's it. You're not asking them to grieve like you. You're not defending how you grieve. You're building that first plank of the translation bridge by getting curious about their language instead of insisting they speak yours. Then you're going to listen, really listen. When they tell you they need silence, don't hear rejection. When they say they need distraction, don't hear disrespect to the person you lost. When they say they need to talk about anything but the loss, don't hear denial. Just take notes, mental or actual, about their grief language. And then, only if they ask, you're going to translate your own grief language for them. When I need to talk about memories, it's not because I'm stuck. It's how I feel close to them. When I cry, I'm not falling apart. I'm letting the grief move through me. You're teaching them your dialect so they can stop misinterpreting your expressions. Tomorrow, you're going to start the practice of daily translation check-ins. Set a time, maybe morning coffee or before bed, when you check in with your grief partner for just 5 minutes.
And here's the format that makes it work. Each person gets to say what they need that day in their grief language without the other person having to match it or change it. Today, I need to sort through photos. Today, I need to not talk about it at all. Today, I need you to just sit with me while I cry. You're not coordinating your grief. You're translating your needs so the other person can support you even while grieving differently. And here's the key. You're going to affirm their needs even when they're opposite of yours. I hear you need quiet today. I'm going to take my need to talk to my friend on the phone. I love you, and we're both doing what we need to do. Over this first week, days 2 through 7, you're going to practice what I call parallel grief. This is where you honor both mourning styles simultaneously without requiring them to match. Maybe one night you go to the grief support group while your partner goes to the gym. You're both grieving, just in different languages. Maybe one evening they need to be alone in their grief, while you need to tell stories with other family members. You text them, "I see you need solitude. I need community. We're both honoring our grief. I'll be home at 9. You're learning to translate, "I need something different than you," from threat language to love language. During this week, you're also going to practice the art of witnessed solitude. This is when you create space for your grief partner to grieve in their way while you're present but not interfering. Maybe they need to sit quietly while you're in the same room reading. Maybe they need to organize the garage while you're nearby but not helping. You're there, but you're not trying to make them grieve like you, and you're going to ask them to do the same for you. I need to look at photos and cry for a while. I don't need you to cry with me or talk, but could you just be in the house? Just knowing you're there helps. You're discovering that connection doesn't require identical expression. By day 30, here's what's going to be different. You're going to be having a hard grief day, the kind where the waves knock you over, and instead of your different mourning styles creating distance, you're going to feel closer because of them. They're going to say, "I hear you need to talk about memories today. I need to go work in the garden because that's how I process, but I want to hear the stories tonight if you still need to tell them." And you're not going to feel abandoned. You're going to feel seen. They've learned your language and you've learned theirs. The grief is still hard, maybe even just as hard, but the isolation is gone. You've built that translation bridge, and now you can both stand on it, grieving in your own ways, but finally, finally feeling less alone. You're not trying to grieve identically anymore. You're becoming fluent in each other's grief languages. You're a grief translator now, someone who understands that love doesn't require matching mourning styles. It requires honoring the different ways hearts break and heal. Listen to this episode again in a week. You'll hear new things. You'll catch instructions you missed. This is your field guide for staying together while grieving apart. Come back to it whenever the different languages start feeling like distance again. You've got this. Start building that bridge today.